Jenny.
Hello, I'm Scott.
Welcome to the seventh episode of the Reading Envy podcast.
Yes, where we'll have what you're reading.
Indeed. Well, today for our guest, we have Seth Wilson. And we know Seth because he's a frequent contributor to the SFF audio podcast and also reviews audiobooks for that site.
Yep.
Yes. And is also a Lord of the Rings fan.
Yes, we did an epic Good Story podcast, a free plug epic. For Scott's other podcast.
I guess you've been making the rounds.
Yeah, I have.
Which is fantastic. I sure enjoy talking to you.
Mm. It's always fun. I love doing this. I want to be like the Leo Laporte of literature podcasts.
Hey, that would be fantastic.
One podcast at a time.
If only we could, if only this was a living.
Yeah. I know, right?
I'd be in heaven, yeah.
Yeah.
And I guess we could also say that Seth has an interesting background. He has a master's degree in history from Oxford University and is headed off in a week to get his master's in English literature.
You can get a master's in English in a week? That is amazing.
He was so excited about it. He's starting in the summer.
For about $10,000, yeah, I'm sure you can.
I used to get emails that say, you know, we'll send you a degree if you send $39.95.
Man.
Yeah.
One of my friends saw those, and he was like, well, you can get a Russian bride, too, and buy them both together and get a discount.
Sold. Love it.
Exactly.
All right. Well, we rolled dice and decided that I would go first.
Snake eyes.
Snake eyes, right.
Yeah, so tell us what you've been reading.
All right. What I've got today, the first book, is by Stanislaw Lem. He's a Polish science fiction writer who passed away not too long ago, I don't believe. But I've read a while back on Audible, they started to publish science fiction novels by Stanislaw Lem. I'm not sure how many they've got now, but I listened to one called Memoirs Found in a Bathtub. Has anyone read that?
I love that book.
Do you really?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Because I listened to it, and I was so confused by it. But it was like, I know there's something here.
No.
Right? So I was intrigued by the author, yet I didn't get it. And then I read The Siberiad, which I thought was wonderful. Love that book. The Siberiad, which is a collection of short stories. So this one is called One Human Minute.
Huh.
And it's not a novel. What it is it's three very long reviews of books that don't exist.
Oh, how awesome is that?
Yeah, it's really something else. I would call it postmodern.
Sure.
Simply because I've very recently been introduced to postmodernism.
Yeah, you talked about The Crying of Lot 49 on a recent podcast, too, and being baffled by that. I have not tried that one yet.
Okay, but yeah, bafflement seems to be what I consider a postmodern trope or feature.
I think Umberto Eco is the closest I've gotten. Neal Stephenson definitely has some strong postmodernist elements.
Now, I like Neal Stephenson quite a bit. He I get along with very well.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, yeah. So the first book review in here is called One Human Minute, and I'll just read the first sentence. This book presents what all the people in the world are doing at the same time in the course of 1 minute. That's the book he reviews.
Wow. Okay.
It was simply begging to be written after the first 3 minutes, the cosmologist's second, and the Guinness Book of World Records, especially since they were bestsellers. Nothing excites publishers and authors today more than a book no one has read, but everyone needs to have. And what he's really doing here is this is like a showcase for philosophy or a reason to think about things or to present things. On page 16, so this is 16 pages into this review, he says, was this book necessary? A member of the French Academy, writing in Le Monde, said that it was inevitable, it had to appear. This civilization of ours, he wrote, which measures everything, counts everything, evaluates everything, weighs everything, which breaks every commandment and prohibition, desires to know all. But the more populous it becomes, the less intelligible it is to itself. It throws itself with the most fury at whatever continues to resist it. There was nothing strange, therefore, in its wanting to have its own portrait, a faithful portrait such as never existed, and an objective one, objectivity being the order of the day. So, in the cause of modern technology, it took a photograph like those done with a reporter's flash camera without touch-ups. So, that was like 16 pages into it.
Wow.
Just trying to even give you a feel for what he's talking about. It's almost as if the book is a collection of every statistic imaginable.
Wow.
But then he goes on and he starts to talk about statistics that are untouchable, that you can't possibly measure, like love, for example. Hmm. You know, impossible to measure. He says somewhere in there, here it is. Let's see, the publishers of One Human Minute failed not only to establish the IQ of politicians, they were also unable to include a register of the sins confessed per minute in the Catholic confessional, or of those acts of kindness whose authors wish to remain anonymous. And so the argument over the precise degree of objectivity or subjectivity of this book cannot be settled. And it's like that throughout the whole thing. Not unlike Lot 49, it's very dense, and you read it, and every paragraph has something, mm-hmm. some thought, some serious, really deep piece of philosophy that you just like, wow, 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 and you keep going. But as a whole, you're just like, that was the oddest thing I think I've ever read. But I was really taken by it. I thought it was really something else. The second review in the book is called, The Upside Down Evolution. And it is about I'll just read the first paragraph again. I mean, very short. Having gained access, by what means I'm not at liberty to reveal, to several volumes on the military history of the 21st century, I pondered, first and foremost, how to hide the information they contained. So he's writing this in the 20th century.
Okay.
Clearly. So he's reviewing a book on the military history of a century that has not yet occurred.
A multi-volume book.
Exactly. Three volumes written in 2105. And he talks about how, he really wants to conceal it. Just amazing.
Did he find them in the bathtub?
I don't have words. Yeah, maybe he did. Maybe he did. And then the third one is, I would think that the most serious one of the three is called The World is Cataclysm, in which he talks philosophically about the role of catastrophe in the shaping of humanity and how it's an extremely important aspect of the history of humanity, how, you know, even the evolution of humanity, how catastrophe was as important as creation.
Hmm.
Really something else. I poked around on the internet, and there's a Wikipedia entry called Stanislaw Lem's Fictitious Criticism of Non-Existing Books. He's done this a few times. There's a book called A Perfect Vacuum, a book called Imaginary Magnitude, and then this one called One Human Minute, and another one called Provocation. It also says here that he is not unique in doing this. It mentions Jorge Luis Borges, a book called Pierre Menard.
Yeah, that's about author, Dante, isn't it?
It says author of The Quixote, or an examination of the work of Herbert Quain.
Don Quixote, that's right. Yeah, I couldn't remember, but that sounds familiar.
Yeah. It says here, See, others, however, read more serious academic reviews. Some of the reviews are parodies, or the books being reviewed are parodies of complete impossibilities, like that we have here. Others are quite serious and can be seen almost as drafts for novels that Lem never got around to write. It can also be said that in this book, and I'm not really sure which book it's referring to, but it says Lem criticizes the postmodernist games for game's sake ethos, turning it against itself. So as I learn what postmodernism is and experience it a little bit more, it could be that I completely have missed what he's trying to turn postmodernism against itself. Interesting concept. But I was fascinated by these. I thought that was cool. It makes me want to try to write one myself. Just come up with some impossibility and review it.
You should.
It may be fun to try. I mean, it's a nice writing exercise anyway.
Yeah, it is. And it, what postmodernism does so well is, like you said at the beginning, gets to the heart of ideas. So, and maybe not coincidentally, that's what science fiction and fantasy sometimes also do so well. By creating something fictitious, not just fictitious set in our own world, but fictitious in a somehow implausible way to kind of deconstruct what's implausible about it, what is remarkable about it, what's interesting about it, that sort of thing.
Yeah, and science fiction to me, when it's at its best, allows us to look at humanity as a whole differently, and that's definitely what Lem has done here. But you know, normally, if you have a philosophical science fiction novel that's got aliens in it, for example, I mean, you're using that in order to look at humanity as a whole, which is really hard to do outside of science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to be able to look at everything as an entirety, you need to be apart from it somehow, not inside it. So to give you that apartness is one of the things that science fiction can do. And I think Lem does it here. I mean, the whole concept of a book that has everything, you know, from a minute of history is just amazing. It's an amazing thing to even think about, and, you know, that it could possibly even exist in this, you know, world that we live in now, you know, where everybody's recording so much and putting so much on the internet.
Right.
That would be, I don't know, it was a fascinating thought. And I'm looking at the book here to find out when exactly he wrote it. The English translation is copyright 1986, so that doesn't mean he wrote it in 86. So I'm not sure when he did. Oh, here it is. It says 1986.
Okay.
So, yeah. Interesting.
Well, that's really cool. That
is really cool, you know, I've been fascinated with Lem. You know, I read somewhere that Pope John Paul II and Lem knew each other.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out that they did, but someone that I had read said that they were friends, and that seems to be an overstatement because I contacted a Lem scholar and passed a few emails with him, and Jenny looked up the Siberiata for me. That was at the same time. I don't know if you remember looking that up for me, Jenny.
Mm-hmm.
But that's an opera that somebody wrote about the Siberiad.
I never could find an actual recording of it or anything, but it's out there.
Yeah, it exists, but there doesn't seem to be a recording.
Mm-hmm.
But it turns out that they've met each other. Pope John Paul II and Stanislaw Lem met each other and things, but they were not, you know, they weren't hanging out with each other, which is how I thought, you know, if we could get some kind of a Inklings pub series of conversations between those two.
Yeah.
How awesome that would have been.
Was Pope John Paul II Polish?
Yes. Yes, he was indeed.
So maybe they would interact in places where, you know, the elite of Poland or something, you know.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Well, I guess Stanislaw Lem ended up in Ukraine, but close enough.
Yeah, sure. But yeah, it turns out that they did know each other. But just not, you know, friends.
Yeah.
Anyway, I find that's just neat, you know, when you find out people with such disparate views. You know, he's definitely like a secular humanist, I would say.
Oh, sure.
But that's my own view of what I've read of him so far. I would certainly not call him a religious person. There are a few things in this book specifically that talk about religion in a negative way.
Yeah, he tends to equate religion with government and show it all as being very absurd.
Yeah, which is, you know, I think Poland is extremely Catholic. Very, very much so.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Well, it was before the USSR took over, which is the era that he
lived. Well, which is why it is now. It is today one of the most Catholic countries there is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, yeah. Which is why Pope John Paul II has such a heavy influence on that country when he was elected pope.
Hmm.
That had a lot to do with that country breaking away from communism. Because of he was able to go there and everybody, you know, it was like an uprising without a revolution. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Well, it's more surprising that they would end up as Catholic and not Orthodox, because most of those countries over there, don't they end up Eastern or Russian Orthodox post-communism?
The Eastern ones, sure. Yeah, but I think Poland was always Roman Catholic.
Hmm.
Poland got swapped back and forth, so often partitioned and swapped between Germany and Russia that I'm sure it's a little bit schizophrenic.
Yeah. Needs its own identity religiously.
Yeah.
Yeah, but what a crazy book that was.
That is crazy. That's awesome.
I just, you know, it's cool. I've still got to read Borges' Labyrinths, and that's got to come up very soon.
Oh, yeah, good.
Borges is great. I've read some of his short stories, and they're fantastic.
Yeah, I've read some of his short stories, too, but this will be the first, you know, complete book I've read, and I think it is actually a collection, not
I think
a novel
so
or anything. But I'm looking forward to it.
Do you have the shiny one?
The shiny one. Mine's black and white cover.
Okay. Mine's shiny.
Yeah. Is it?
And I think one day that'll make me read it, right?
Sure.
Ooh, look, shiny.
Shiny.
I love it. All right, Seth, what have you got on the table?
Well, Tamahome last time, partly him and partly just other events, inspired me to get back into comic books. So what I have is a newish comic book called Miss Marvel by G. Willow Wilson is the writer of the comic.
I love her.
Oh, really? You'll have to tell me why in a minute.
Yeah.
Anyway, what got me interested in this is around last November, this comic was announced. It's a fairly new comic, or at least it's a new iteration of a comic, since comic book characters are often recycled. Last November, it was announced that the title character, Miss Marvel, would be a Muslim teenager in living in New York City, well, New Jersey, actually. And I just thought that was a really, really cool, really important concept for America to have a Muslim superhero. I've read about, and unfortunately I don't know the names, but there have been stories recently of superheroines in other countries who, Middle Eastern countries who fight crime wearing a burqa and that sort of thing, which is awesome, but I think it's especially great that, Marvel and this writer and hopefully the general public are embracing a superhero who is a Muslim American girl. And so far it's really great. It's just four issues in. I think this first run, I'm not a comic expert by any means. This first run will be five issues, and then hopefully there'll be a trade paperback available for people like, I think Tam says he's a trade waiter. So,
that's cool. So what kind of a superhero is she?
Well, it's fun because she's, so far, she's only really discovering her powers. Essentially, she's a shapeshifter. But she doesn't kind of realize that. She kind of gets a dose of strange fog when she's at a party and passes out and has these visions Iron Man and Captain America and Captain Marvel, who's a kind of an older version of Miss Marvel. Anyway, he has visions of these three, and Captain Marvel is this kind of blonde-haired woman, and wakes up and finds herself transformed, and initially she's blonde, and so that, you know, that initially had me concerned because, you know, I was afraid that the comic book was going in a direction of, oh, well, to be a superhero, you've got to break free of your roots and become this busty blonde superheroine. But as it turns out, you know, she's moving beyond that and learning to take control of her powers and saying, well, actually, you know, having a big flowing cape and all this hair everywhere is not the most practical for a superhero. So it's really neat, and I think every issue so far has included some untranslated Arabic, which is frustrating but also cool. To tie back to Name of the Rose, which I mentioned earlier, Umberto Eco does that in Name of the Rose. He throws in untranslated Latin and Middle High German and all that sort of stuff. And if you get it, you get it. If you don't, it's too bad. Although there's a book called Key to the Name of the Rose that's really good for translating all those, but I wonder if it takes the fun out of it. But anyway, yeah, this comic is really great. Comics are a challenge for me because I'm legally blind, and so reading comics in paper is not practical for me. Mm-hmm. So I use an iPad and use the Comixology app, and I can magnify things pretty big and read them without too much trouble, although it's still more strained than it would be for most people.
Yeah, interesting. Are you able to enjoy the art at all?
Some. I mean, I miss action in the art, but I enjoy stylistic touches, and I think that's part of why I enjoy certain comic art styles, if they are, you know, really bold and kind of. It's why I enjoyed the animated stuff in the Kill Bill movies.
Oh yeah,
and that sort of thing. It's just very very stylized. There's a cartoon called Samurai Jack a while back. That had very stylized, kind of very Japanese, almost very suggestive lines and that sort of thing. And so I like that kind of art style. But yeah, I'll never be an art critic.
This author, I know she's more known for comics, but that's almost everything she's done. But the book that I've read of hers is Aleph the Unseen. Mm. Have you heard of that book?
No.
It was probably one of my favorite books I read in 2012. I had to go back and look at when I read it. It's a teenage hacker novel, you know, kind of like along the lines of Ready Player One or Little Brother. But it's a teenage hacker. He's half Indian, half Arab, and he lives in an unnamed Middle Eastern country. And it's just his adventure. And it's kind of part fantasy. But it has issues in it like racism and religious difference. And it's written right before the Arab Spring happened, you know, quote unquote, but it could have been written about it for all of the things that happened. So I don't know. I was really captivated by her writing. So I imagine that translates really well to graphic novels.
Oh, it does.
And
that explains why this is such comfortable ground for her. Cause you know, she really plays well with the themes of, you know, this girl genuinely wanting to. So in the first issue, she, you know, sneaks out of her house, and goes to this party, you know, kind of traditional high school drama stuff, you know, her fairly strict, they're pretty middle of the road, but leaning on the strict side, her parents, you know, don't want her to go to a party where there's going to be alcohol and stuff like that. And so she goes to this party and you think, oh, she's going to have a fun time and all that. And then they try to give her alcohol and there's this great shot of her spitting it out. And she's like, no, you know, so her trying to decide where her comfort zone is, and balancing Muslim expectations against American expectations. There's another issue where she goes to Sunday school in their local mosque, and main thing I gathered from that was that Islamic Sunday school is about as boring as Christian or Jewish Sunday school, which is what I went to.
Yep.
She captures it pretty well.
Yeah, I definitely recommend picking them up. And again, I mean, even if they weren't as good as they are, I think I'd still probably be reading them just to support some diversity in comics. Because I don't know, it's hard. The superhero genre is something that I have a love hate relationship with. I mean, it's in some ways it's the ultimate wish fulfillment, and it's incredibly visceral and cool and fun to watch, but for most cases, it seems like they've recycled the same kind of themes and tropes for decades now, except for things like The Watchmen by Alan Moore, that sort of thing.
Yeah. League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Yeah.
Yeah, I haven't read a heck of a lot of superhero comics, but I do watch most of those movies.
Mm-hmm.
And it is astounding how many superhero movies there are. It's just, I think that they've perfected it.
Yeah.
And I think people are going to get tired of them any day now. You've got two big ones right now, but anyway. But you're right on the themes. I mean, the themes are the same.
Yeah. I've been reading this book called Supergirls by Mike Madrid, and it's a history of superhero females in comic books. And, you know, it's depressing as you'd expect, because although the female characters tend to be, you know, more compassionate and a little more balanced than their male counterparts, they're often playing second fiddle. And in fact, he points to the very fact that most of the female characters are called, you know, girls, Supergirl, Ms. Marvel, the only exception, main exception being Wonder Woman, whereas most of the other male characters are Iron Man, Ant-Man, Captain America, you know, things like that. And I think it's starting to change, and I haven't gotten very far into the book, so I know that those things are starting to change. Batwoman, most notably, is now a lesbian, which I think is cool.
Yeah, I've read a few of those. Those are actually really good.
Yeah.
She's really strong.
Yeah.
Not completely undefeatable, you know, she still gets hurt and everything, but she's a complex character, and she's not just, you know, she doesn't need other people protecting her. So she's a good character.
There's a book called Batwoman Elegy, which I think is kind of made that character. Maybe
I think that's the one I've read. Yeah.
That's the famous one. I've not read that yet, but there's a newer comics about her.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool. Very cool. All right, Jenny.
Well,
what's up now?
From the very fantastical to the very realistic, I guess. I came across this book at work. I didn't know it was out. It's The Diaries of George Orwell. And I ran through it like crazy. I don't know why. It's just very fascinating to me. George Orwell being one of the authors that's been with me my whole life. My dad had me read 1984 for the first time when I was 10. And I've read it every few years my whole entire life. So it's been
a wow.
Important part of my paranoia education.
You know, one of the most interesting things, I think 1984 is a book, it doesn't matter if you're left or right.
Yeah.
I think if it's, he's like the champion of the right and the champion of the left,
uh-huh.
You know, both at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, they both point to him as an ideal. Which is really interesting to me.
Yeah.
But anyway.
And so many of the things that he writes about in his novels and his essays and his stories are based on things from his own life. And the diaries range from 1931 to 1949, so it's not everything. But at first it's very adventure-y and domestic. Like, he has a hop-picking diary where he dresses up like a tramp and goes and picks hops with people. And then he has one that accompanied his adventure that became the book, The Road to Wigan Pier. And then after that, as the war is starting to come together and as the war happens, he has domestic diaries that he keeps alongside other diaries. So he has a diary where he records how many eggs his chickens are having and what
funny.
He planted and what the weather was like. You know, like, it's just like a record of the farm. And then there's the wartime diary. Well, what the editor did for some of them is he interlaced them. And so there's this really interesting dichotomy of all these terrifying things that are happening that they only see partial news from. And Orwell read all the papers. He read the right papers. He read the left papers. He read the forbidden communist papers. You know, he knew all of these people, all these journalists, so he kept up with all of this stuff, and he saw a lot of it coming. So it's really kind of fascinating.
Man, that's awesome.
Yeah. And actually, someone in the course of his journal actually said, had kind of said, you know, you knew this stuff was going to happen. And I have this quote I wanted to read. It's from 1940, the 8th of June. Where I feel that people like us understand the situation better than so-called experts is not in any power to foretell specific events, but in the power to grasp what kind of world we are living in. At any rate, I have known since about 1931 that the future must be catastrophic. I could not say exactly what wars and revolutions would happen, but they never surprised me when they came. I could feel it in my belly. So it's really interesting. And he tries to join the war efforts, but his health is too bad. So he can't ever really do that, although his wife works for the propaganda office, which I think has a different, nicer term. So he's very close to all of the work, but most of the time he's at home tending his farm and reading the newspaper and listening to the radio. So it's a very interesting situation for him.
Did he spend any time in India?
Before these journals, I'm trying to remember which country it was.
So not in these journals, but...
Not in these, yeah. No. And
one of my formative reading experiences was Shooting an Elephant by Orwell.
Yeah, there's India, and then there was Singapore.
Pretty young when I read it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because he spent a lot of time when he was younger doing things like that.
And he was a correspondent, I think, in those countries, right? Wasn't he write for newspapers or something?
Yeah, and even during the war, he did book reviews and movie reviews.
All right.
But he was very bitter about them because he's like, who cares about this stuff? This isn't what people should care about. And so they were all very kind of sarcastic, I think.
Well, that's funny because, you know, I disagree. You know, I feel like in some ways that's the time that you should care about those things more or cherish them more. And
right. Mm-hmm. Well, he would get really frustrated because no one seemed to care that they were in the middle of a war, you know, because they just wanted to be entertained. Yeah. And
it sounds so familiar.
It does. And another really interesting thing to me is that although he keeps a domestic diary, he doesn't write about his emotions, except for if it's like frustration or anger or, you know, righteous anger. But like his wife dies along the way here, and
wow,
his brother-in-law dies, and he mentions going or being away in these places, but the editor in the footnotes fills in the gaps, like he was here because his brother-in-law died, or you know, his wife died when they were going to move and that's why he moved to the Hebrides, you know. Otherwise he doesn't ever mention it in there, and I don't know why. What I mean, in my world, a diary is where you would put things like that.
Yeah, right.
So it's kind of, it was nice that the editor knew so much. And I think it's the same person that worked on the collected works of Orwell. So because he references a lot. He says the CW for that.
Mm-hmm.
So you could kind of read them alongside each other, which would probably be a good way to do it. But you see a lot, especially near the end, his frustration with advertising, his frustration with bureaucracy. And he wrote 1984 near the end of his life. So all of these things were leading up to that. And Animal Farm comes out along the way. But he also turns it into a radio play that the BBC put on right before the war. So that was kind of fun.
Yeah,
I wonder if that's still available. I mean, it should be public domain by now, in theory. We need to ask Jesse.
Yeah, if it was around.
Oh my gosh, it's public domain!
Heck yeah.
I'll say one more thing before I stop.
Yes,
please do.
He, in 1940, wrote about the 99%.
Oh,
really?
Wow.
Yeah, we talk about predicting the future. Man, there was a woman who was very wealthy, Lady Oxford, and she wrote to the Daily Telegraph, and she was talking about how, you know, oh, times are so hard. I had to move into the city, and half of my maids can't come with me, you know.
Oh, heavens, no.
And so he was like, apparently nothing will ever teach these people that the other 99% of the population exists. It's amazing.
Look at that.
Yeah.
Man, that's incredible.
That is something. He was something else.
Mitt Romney should have read that.
Yes, indeed.
Yep.
Cool.
So So it was just interesting. I'm not someone who's ever going to probably sit down and read a history book, unless it's really highly recommended to me, and then maybe even not then. But I like learning about history through journals and diaries and letters. That's kind of my way of doing it.
Yeah,
so this is a good one for that.
It's all connected. I mean, as you said at the beginning, I have a master's in history, and I decided not to pursue that career path in academia because I don't know. I connect more with the artistic resonance of literature and creativity and the creative arts, and yet they're windows onto the same thing that history as a discipline is trying to explore. It's just different methodology, different focus, that sort of thing. So, I know exactly what you're saying.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and one more little one-liner for you. No one is patriotic about taxes.
I am in theory.
Nice.
Yeah.
Very good.
So, Scott, did you want to talk about another book?
Yes, I have one more. Where do you folks stand on the George R. R. Martin? Are you followers of the TV show Game of Thrones? Either of you?
I watched one episode of it. It's too violent for me. I read one of the books, and I will not be reading anymore until he finishes.
Until he finishes, which may be never.
Right. Yeah. But, I mean, they're really readable, I guess, is my opinion.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what I wanted to talk about is one of my absolute favorite audiobooks of all time. And I finished re-listening to this just yesterday. It's The Hedge Knight by George R.R. Martin.
Oh, wow.
Have either of you heard of that?
I've read it, but a long time ago, and I remember the plot basics, but it's Dunkin' Egg stories.
Yeah, exactly. So what happened is there was an anthology called Legends, which was edited by Robert Silverberg. And it contained novellas from the universes of various authors. They were invited to contribute to the anthology by writing a story from their own universes. So Orson Scott Card wrote an Alvin Maker story. George R. R. Martin wrote this Hedge Knight, which is a Dunkin' Egg story from the same universe as The Song of Ice and Fire. Silverberg himself wrote a Madripoor story, and McCaffrey wrote a Pern story. So it was a pretty thick volume called Legends. And I think since then there's been a Legends 2, but I'm not positive. They came out on audio, and I have... some favorite narrators, and Frank Muller if he's not number one, he's in the top three.
Mm-hmm.
I absolutely love that guy. Unfortunately, he passed away. He got in a motorcycle accident.
Wow.
But he narrated a few of my favorite books, like Beach Music, for example. I love his narration of Beach Music by Pat Conroy. And he narrated this one called The Hedge Knight. And since then, it just sits on my iPod all the time. And every now and then, I'll see it there and I'll listen to a little bit of it. But I just listened to the whole thing again, and I was just blown away again. I absolutely love it. The story is very typical. This guy, Duncan, is out. He's a squire to what's called a hedge knight, which is basically a knight that has no house in this universe. So he's not a Targaryen or a Stark or anything like that. He just is independent. He'll fight for whoever he decides to fight for. So Duncan is a squire to this knight. This knight passes away. He's a very old guy. And Dunk basically takes his stuff and starts to try to be a knight. And then, you can probably... say, well, obviously what's going to happen is that Dunk, this poor hedge knight, is going to be a better knight than all the noble knights, and you'll be right. That's exactly what happens. But the execution of the story, for me to listen to a story over and over is not very typical, but it's flawless, in my opinion. I just love it, absolutely adore this book. So it's a novella length, takes about, I'm guessing, maybe 3 hours on audio. Mm. Just perfectly read by Frank Muller. And it is available on Audible. You've got to go to the Legends, look up Legends, and he's there with, I forgot what stories match with him. I think there's actually three. So I think the Pern story's in there, and then the Hedge Knight is in there. But you really want the Frank Muller version, just because he's just so good at reading it.
Wow.
And just to complete it, the Hedge Knight is a Dunk and Egg story, and there are now three of them. Three novellas. I believe Martin is planning to publish a book with the three in it, with a bunch of art, it sounds like. The stuff that I was reading on his blog said that he keeps trying to get to more of those because he absolutely loves these characters, and they're very interesting. But he's unable to get to it. So he says, well, we'll just publish a book that has the three in it.
Yeah.
So that sounds like that's what's coming out. The last thing I need to say is it takes place about 90 years before Game of Thrones. So it has very little to do with the Game of Thrones. It's really just the universe, and some of the names are familiar, like, you know, Targaryen is in there, and Lannister is in there, and Baratheon is in there. But these are... The characters in a Game of Thrones are descended from these guys.
Wow.
Yeah, and for the for readers of Game of Thrones, there's this pretty surprising. The other character, Egg, is a sort of, am I remembering right, Scott? He was sort of an apprentice that that Duncan takes on.
Exactly.
And there's a pretty surprising.
He takes him on as his own squire. He
says,
you know,
that's right.
You can be my squire. And he's like, you know, I will allow you to do this, you know, that type of thing. You know, he's trying to be regal.
Yeah.
But yeah, it turns out Egg is important.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, I have a love-hate relationship with the Game of Thrones series, the books anyway. I've read all of them. I wish I hadn't read the last two because maybe two or three things happen, which makes sense because they were originally meant to be kind of flashbacks in the upcoming book, which is The Winds of Winter. So we were supposed to go from Storm of Swords to Winds of Winter, and the Robert Jordan creep set in, and he decided that these stories he has in his head are actually really important. And
right.
And I can't take that away from him. He's an amazing writer, and Game of Thrones is great. Clash of Kings is okay. Storm of Swords, it's just Swords is wonderful.
Yeah.
So,
and I've read all three of those, and I did read A Feast for Crows, although I couldn't tell you a thing about
it. Yep.
A single thing. And then I haven't read the latest one.
Dance with Dragons is, in some ways it's better, in some ways it's worse. But I mean, I'm invested in at least the print series. I watched the first season of the show and haven't watched any more, not for any particular reason, except that I don't have TV and HBO.
And I'm the same way on that, too. I didn't say that myself. I have watched not even all of episode one. And there's no particular reason. I'm just like,
yeah,
I guess I've seen that already. You know what I mean? Because Game of Thrones, you know, Martin writes in this just such a cinematic, picturesque, plain, direct, very vivid manner.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just... I don't know. That was enough for me. I never felt like, oh, I can't wait to see this.
You know, the funny thing is that it seems like people are reverse engineering into Martin because they see the show and they're like, well, you mean there's more? And then they read the books. Like people who maybe wouldn't have read fantasy before.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Kind of interesting.
Yeah, and that's good. That's good. George R. R. Martin was a great writer before Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
I mean, he's got a huge body of work, really. Audible has published all of his short fiction in Dream Songs. There's three volumes out there. And that is super interesting because he does it in chronological order. And each section, what's really interesting is his introduction to the section. It's like, okay, here's where I was a fan writer. I was writing this kind of stuff. And his essays are just great, really worthwhile. And then he'll have two or three examples of that period of his career. And then he'll talk some more. And then there will be two or three examples of that period. And it's three volumes long called Dream Songs.
I love that. And I think audiobooks underutilize that. I wish they would do more. They're starting to more and more. the edition of The Great Gatsby, and I wish I had a reference for it, maybe we can put it in the show notes, I just happened to get an audio edition of The Great Gatsby, and I had never read it before. And it felt like the story was wrapping up, but I still had 2 hours of audio left, and I'm like, what's going on here? Turns out there are a lot of Fitzgerald's letters that the narrator recorded involving the writing and reception of The Great Gatsby. There's a correspondence with Willa Cather about the story. There's, I think, some correspondence with his editor or another editor who worked with Hemingway. So there's a lot of interesting stuff, and I feel like audio is a great venue for either authors themselves or other ancillary figures to tell stories around stories.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. There's a when King Kong came out, the Peter Jackson version, there was a few King Kong audiobooks that came across our desk. And one of them was from Fullcast Audio.
Wow.
I'm sorry. It wasn't the Fullcast Audio version. It was the Blackstone Audio version.
Okay.
It was just called King Kong. But the whole last CD, it was back when, you know, all of our audiobooks were CDs. But the last CD was full of interviews or commentary from various science fiction writers about King Kong. And I remember Harlan Ellison saying, King Kong died for our sins. and that stuck in my mind. But it was like, 7 minutes of Harlan Ellison talking about King Kong is just awesome.
Yeah.
And, you're right. It's just perfect on audio. It's just perfect for audio. And would love to see more of it.
Neil Gaiman does some great introductions to books. He introduces the Fritz Leiber. All of his short stories were collected into 7 books on Audible. Well, I think they were collected in print first, but Neil Gaiman introduces the Audible versions. And it's just wonderful listening to authors explain what influenced them or what literature moves them. It's, I don't know, there's a strange meta quality to that that I like.
Yeah, there is. I feel the same way, too. All right, so if you're an author and you're listening to this podcast.
Yeah,
indeed. But I agree with you. All right, Seth.
All right, my second book is a nonfiction book. It's called Reality is Broken, Why Games Make Us Better and How They Can Change the World by Jane McGonigal.
Jane McGonigal, she have a TED Talk?
Yes, she does. Yes, I have not watched it. I should have done my research better.
No, I think I know exactly who you're talking about.
Okay, yeah. She's a video game developer herself, and although I don't play games now, mostly because I don't have time for it, and also my vision and overall reflexes are not good enough to play the sorts of games that are prevalent nowadays. I grew up around video games, grew up playing, Mario and Zelda and Final Fantasy, and so games like that actually influenced the way I think about even things like fantasy and aesthetic and story and stuff like that. And so, I was expecting this book to be sort of the standard reaction that video game players and creators have when they're, brought against the accusations of rotting kids' minds or driving them to violence or that sort of thing. So I was expecting the book to be kind of defensive in that way, in the sense that, games make you more, they help with coordination and they make you more creative, they make you better problem solving. And that does get brought up in the book some, but she goes a lot further than that. She ties it into psychology, the psychology of play. There's a psychologist named Winnicott. Well, Carl Jung even gets into this, but just the idea that traditional psychoanalysis has been so focused on unearthing the skeletons and the negatives in our lives, and this idea of positive psychology, of finding ways to the term she uses, happiness hacking, to just make ourselves happier. And that's, that's not a bad thing. It's not escapism. It's, making the world happy. So,
which is great. Yeah.
It's great. So she talks about conventional, video games, console games, computer games, but she also talks about some really neat game ideas. So for example, she had a concussion in 2009, and turned out that the effects were lasting longer than she thought. And so basically her quote was, either I'm going to need to turn this into a game or I'm going to die. Because she was just so hopeless about it. So she kind of came up with this whole scheme for a game of, you know, levels that she would complete. Like, it might just be, okay, tonight I'm going to eat a salad and some protein instead of the ice cream and cookies that I've been eating to make myself feel better. I get an achievement for that. She's got, you know, power-ups like friends to call, that sort of thing. So what they call in the app development industry nowadays, gamification, things like Foursquare or Runkeeper, things that kind of turn travel or fitness into a game. Things like that she's a really big advocate of.
That's cool.
This is a concept we work with in the library world, too.
Okay.
When we're, you know, certain things we want students to learn, and sometimes if you gamify it, they can learn it better because it's fun, and so they'll
right.
be more likely to absorb it, and because when you, it's the way your brain connects ideas when you're gaming versus when you're just reading.
Mm-hmm.
Or when you're just listening, it connects more of the parts, I guess.
Yeah.
And it just leads to better learning. So we try to use that sometimes. So this sounds like a book that I would want to read.
It's very good. I mean, a lot of it is kind of self-promotion for her and a lot of projects she's created, which, you know, on the one hand, she's earned it. So can't fault her too much for that.
But they're also ideas you can steal, right?
Sure. The problem with it is the book's a couple of years old, and so some of the projects that she came up with are now defunct. So, for example, she came up with, so people are happier when they're dancing, but most people are either too nervous to dance or don't feel like they have the opportunity to, and so she came up with this online game called Top Secret Dance Off, where you essentially you put on a mask or something that covers part of your face to conceal your identity, and then you do these dancing challenges, and usually often people will have one friend who they have recording the videos, but that's really all it takes, and you could even do it with your own camera setup. So, for example, one of the challenges will be, you know, dance with a tree, and you know, you level up as you do these dances. And so I looked up this website because I thought, oh, that sounds like something silly and fun to do. And the site is still around, but it was going into hiatus around 2009 or something and hasn't been revived since. So
we can bring it back.
I know. She has another game called Cruel to Be Kind, and it's the number 2 and the letter B, just to be cool, I guess. But the idea is it's one of those games where there are many people playing it, but the players don't know who the other players are. And so to, quote-unquote, kill the other players, you have to do some sort of random act of kindness. And so it's a game that would be played on a university campus or in some urban area. And so you have essentially people walking around. They don't know who the other players are, so they're doing random acts of kindness for all sorts of strangers. and on the other hand, they have to be kind of nonchalant about doing it because they don't want to tip off a potential player that they're, you know, playing the game. So she's just really inventive. I feel happier just talking about it.
Yeah, that's neat. Yeah, her talk was great. She talked a little bit about the gamification of her recovery,
mm-hmm.
like you were mentioning.
Yeah, the game called Super.
That's what the whole TED Talk was about.
Okay, and I need to watch that.
And the value of games as a result, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I thought she was riveting. I thought she was good.
Hmm.
Well, thanks a million for that.
Anytime.
Cool. All right, Jenny.
Take us home.
All right. Well, a few weeks ago, I was headed to the South Carolina Book Festival, which happens the week after Mother's Day every year. And since I knew ahead of time I was going, I had this list of authors that I wanted to try to read. And so I read a bunch of poets in April and got to meet a few of those. And I also finally read a book by Ron Rash, who is a very well-known Southern writer. And has written a wide range of both novels and books of short stories. And so I picked Serena by Ron Rash, which is just about to blow up because Jennifer Lawrence and Bradley Cooper are in the middle of making a movie about it based on
wow.
it. Yeah, so a lot of people are going to be reading this
yeah.
book. And if you haven't heard about Ron Rash, you're going to be hearing about him more, I have the feeling.
So buy stockpiles of the book and sell them on eBay.
Well, and this is this is an interesting story because, you know, I haven't lived in the South my whole life. I've lived here for 8 years, and this novel is about 1929, and there are newlyweds, George and Serena Pemberton, and they own a timber logging empire, and they're located in North Carolina, the area that the government wants to turn into the Smoky Mountain National Park. And so they're making tons of money, and they don't want the government to take that money-making opportunity away from them. So it's kind of about them trying to maintain their empire. Both George and Serena are not good people. They don't mind killing. They don't mind lying. They don't mind swindling people out of their money. And it's kind of an interesting novel because no one is very likable.
Wow.
And then halfway through, Serena is really the force to be reckoned with. She finds out she can't have children. But before George married her, he had a son with someone illegitimately. And so she goes off to try to find that son and kill him.
Wow.
So it kind of becomes like high stakes. Who's going to be more violent? Who's going to win? Will love win? So I just thought this book was great. I've been to Smoky Mountain National Park. I've driven on the Blue Ridge Parkway multiple times. I only live about an hour from there. So it was really fascinating to read a book about the time before all that stuff existed. You can tell he's done a lot of research, and it's a great book. Great characters, great setting. I just really enjoyed it.
That's cool. And how did you enjoy the book festival?
Oh, it was great. You know, I think what surprised me the most is how close the authors that are part of the festival are with each other. It's clearly a close-knit community. Like, I went to a panel that had Ron Rash and George Singleton and Marjorie Wentworth, who is the South Carolina Poet Laureate.
Oh, wow.
And they were, like, making jokes and, like, teasing each other the whole time.
How cool.
And it was just really fun. So I'm going to keep going back every year as long as I live in South Carolina. Have that weekend blocked out on my calendar now.
How much does this book resemble? I haven't read much Faulkner, but is it Faulkner-esque, would you say, in terms of its critique of the South? Or?
Well, I think Faulkner tries hard to be... Faulkner's really more of the Deep South.
Okay.
You know, and this is, at least, I haven't read everything Ron Rash has written, but this doesn't have the same feeling of Deep South. This is much more Appalachia.
Oh, okay.
Mountain people, you know.
Gotcha.
And then that whole era when, what is the work corps that was created?
Oh, the CCC?
Yeah, I can't remember what it stands for.
I'm trying to, Civilian Conservation Corps or something like that.
Yeah, all the people that were really down and out that needed jobs, and this park in particular utilize that workforce. So it's more like the people that used to work in the mines, and they came out and then they were working as loggers, and then they came and worked for the park. So like these groups of people migrating to where the work is. I think Faulkner tends to look at people who are a little more wealthy than that.
I gotcha. Yeah, that makes sense.
So these are people that are more migrational, and Faulkner's about people who live in small towns and...
So this is more Grapes of Wrath, Steinbeck Grapes of Wrath, than Faulkner.
Well, it's that era, yeah.
I'm sorry, I'm trying to pigeonhole it.
Yeah, no, it's okay, because it helps to try to understand
it,
right?
Yeah, that's what I'm trying, because I've never heard of him, so I was just trying to, you know, it's funny when you read a book blurb and it's like so-and-so with pirates. Okay.
Well, I guess maybe this would be more similar to, like, Cold Mountain, or...
Oh, yeah, okay.
At least, you know, in landscape.
Yeah.
But I did already buy another Ron Rash book because I was like, you know, I really enjoyed that. I felt like I learned some things too, which isn't awful. And it was funny because, like, when all the characters are unlikable and you just can't stop reading, that's a good combination for me.
Yeah. Almost like a Coen Brothers movie.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, what is it about Southern writers, too?
I think there's definitely a unique breed. And they talked about that at the festival, too. Mm. You know, it's not like you ever talk about Plains writers or desert writers, but you do talk about southern writers, and still now you do. And these authors are traveling all over the country, so it's not like they're only selling books in the South.
Yeah.
But there's just something special about writing about southern characters and southern places, that it has just so much placeness to it. And people are so connected to it still. I think that makes a big difference.
Yeah. Yep, yep. I sure enjoy Pat Conroy.
Yes, I did get to see him, too, at the festival.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, that's incredible.
He and his brothers and sisters sat and talked about their father.
That's so cool.
Wow, that was something to experience.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah, and I had read an entire Pat Conroy book in my whole rush to try to be prepared.
I was going to say, I've not read your book ahead of me.
I've read two.
But I know, you know, my mom is a fan of his stuff, and so she's talked about The Great Santini and Prince of Tides, so I feel like I know them indirectly.
Well, here's a little tip that I learned from his brothers and sisters. You know, The Great Santini is based on his life.
Yeah.
And his father. But according to them, they would have loved to have the father in that book. Because he at least was nice every once in a while, and that was not their experience. I was like, oh my gosh.
Okay, boy.
Just incredible. Yeah, it's tough to even think about.
Yeah. Do you guys have statewide book festivals in your state? Do you know?
I don't know. I'm sure we do. I mean, Texas has Texas everything because, you know, we're practically our own country. So I'm sure we do. But I'm not aware of them.
Yeah, I don't know of a book festival, but I go to a convention or two every year in Salt Lake City, which is the state I live in.
Right.
The next one coming up is WesterCon, which is a traveling convention. It'll be here in July.
Cool.
I hope to go to it. Cory Doctorow is a guest of honor.
Wow. Oh, cool.
That's fantastic.
And then the Writing Excuses crew will be there.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
Yeah, Mary Robinette Cole and
Howard Taylor.
Dan Wells and Howard Taylor. Yeah.
Wow, that's perfect.
Those are local to me. Mary's not, but I've met the other ones several times just at the local convention. They're all local.
Yeah.
So those, you know, you say that they're tight-knit, but, you know, the writers here are too.
Sure. Right.
It's just like they know each other from all these conventions, and they hang out, and you know, every now and then they go out to eat in a huge group, and I've been in that group once or twice.
Well, there are so many Mormon science fiction and fantasy writers. A lot of them from Utah, and I'm assuming most of them are Mormon, and that's a whole different topic. But I mean, I think it's certainly very cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. It is.
Yeah. And the nice thing about, like what you said, like getting to meet authors that you've read is, I don't know, it's a really nice experience.
It really is. And, you know, I would urge people to try a nice small convention if you can, because those are the best. I've been to Worldcon, and Worldcon was neat in its own way. But the local convention, the Conduit convention that I go to, I mean, you get to meet people in person and talk to them, you know, like... You know, David Brin, David Weber, these guys aren't local, but they, you know, they bring in a guest of honor every year. And you meet these people.
That's fantastic.
It's neat. It's just a really great way to spend a weekend.
I'd love to go to WorldCon in Helsinki. I guess it's next year or the year after.
Oh, really?
Sounds amazing. Yeah.
That'd be cool. Yeah. Yeah, I think next year it's in Spokane, so maybe Helsinki is the one after that.
Yeah, good. I have some time to save some.
The reason that I was like Spokane is because I'm in driving distance to Spokane.
Oh, wow. David Eddings was from there. I remember that because he was one of the first fantasy authors I read. And I remember reading the blurb on his books.
Thank you for listening to the Reading Envy podcast. You can find us at readingenvy.com.